God that we want to see this morning in John chapter 3. Of course, you know that verse very well when we start with that first verse, John 3:16. As you're turning there, one last announcement. If you are going to be helping with the FBF either tomorrow night or Tuesday morning, I would like to meet with you, please, as a group in the junior church classroom after Sunday school. So if you're going to be helping at all tomorrow night or Tuesday with registration, with the kitchen, anything, I'd like to meet with you at that time in the junior church classroom. With a California steamer, the Central American caught fire and was sinking in 1865. One of the stewardesses ran into the passenger cabins and began collecting all the gold that she could find, tied it in the apron around her waist, and ran to try to catch the lifeboat that had already begun to leave from the ship. In her eagerness to be saved, she leaped from the deck, trying to get to the lifeboat, missed it, and head first went into the water like a cannonball. The weight of what she loved the most dragged her to the bottom of the sea like a millstone. I say that as an illustration because love is not always good. It depends upon the object loved. What she loved the most led to her destruction. What man loves determines where he will spend eternity. You see, you cannot love a clean house and disarray at the same time. You cannot love both health and disease. If you love, you must hate. If you hate, you must love. In this passage that we're going to read today and study, Jesus continues to talk to Nicodemus about heavenly things. He mentioned heavenly things in verse 12. But now he's going to contrast God's love and man's love. So the title of this message today, which is also its theme, is God's love and man's love. I initially had it God's love versus man's love, but it's not always versus man's love. It can be God's love and man's love, but it depends on how man responds to that love, if it's God's love and man's love, or God's love versus man's love. What you love will either save you or doom you. I want you to see, first of all, in verses 16 to the first part of verse 18, the compassionate love of God. You know verse 16, so without looking, perhaps you could just quote that as we say that together. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. You'll still see that verse under the eyes of football players. You'll still see that sometimes in the end zone when people hold the John 3:16 up. It is such a well-known verse that I fear that people just kind of dismiss it now. But I think that when we see it in its context, going on to verse 17, we'll be able to see something a little bit more, because verse 17 also starts with the same word as verse 16, for God sent not his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. He that believeth on him is not condemned. Now let's stop there, because we're talking about the compassionate love of God, and we're going to get to that word but in verse 18, which is a contrast. But let's look at verses 16, 17, first part of 18, because that shows us the compassionate love of God. I want you to see that the compassionate love of God is demonstrated in at least three ways. Number one, in giving. In giving. Again, verse 16, God so loved the world that he gave. True love is always, always demonstrated in giving, not in getting. I have mentioned this to you before. If you came to Benjamin's wedding this last summer, I said it then. Because it was set up, the wedding, when I married my wife, by her pastor. when he said to me, Dan, you are not today getting a wife. You are giving to Juanita a husband. Juanita, you are not today getting a husband. You are giving to Dan a wife. You see, marriage is the same thing. It is not about getting. It is about giving. And if somebody is in a marriage to get, it's going to end in divorce. It is about giving. You see, that's what true love is. That's what agape love is. It is about giving. It is possible to give without loving, though, but it is impossible to love without giving. God's love is to be admired, somebody once said, not because the world is so big, but because the world is so bad. If Jesus is the Savior of the world, and he is, that says a great deal about Jesus, but it says nothing positive about the world. You see, folks, it is the world that God loved, not just the elect. He loved the world. The whosoever who believeth in him is the elect. But God so loved the world. Any can choose to believe. You don't have to sit there and wonder if I'm the elect. You're the whosoever. He gave his only begotten son to the world. And you'll notice there in John 3:16 that the opposite of perishing is to have life eternal. And the opposite of life eternal is to perish. There's only two kinds of people in the world today. There are those who have everlasting life, and there are those who are perishing. Two kinds. The compassionate love of God is demonstrated in giving. Secondly, the compassionate love of God is demonstrated in sending. Look at the first part of verse 17. For God sent not his son into the world to condemn the world. In giving his son, God sent him into the world. In order for man to believe into him and not perish, God had to give him or send him into the world. The purpose for Jesus' first coming was not yet for judgment. His second coming is. But the first coming, as Jesus says here, God did not send his son into the world to condemn, to judge the world. That's not why he came that first time. But one day he will come in judgment. But we're focusing on the compassionate love of God and the reason for him sending him. It was not for judgment, but for the work of salvation. Now, why is it that Jesus had to specify that he was not sent to judge? Because guilty man expects judgment because of his sin. If you've ever done anything against your parents or you've done something that you knew you were guilty of, you're waiting for the judgment. Like I did when I was in a second grade on my way to elementary school in Omaha, Nebraska. Mom and Dad were in Missouri. They had hired a babysitter to watch all eight of us kids. So that morning, my brother Terry, who's now a missionary to Sri Lanka somehow, we're walking on our way to school, and Terry said, hey, let's take my wagon. He had this nice blue wagon. It was, in those days, those wagons were heavy, well-built. And we began to pull it up the hill on the way to school, thinking that after school, we're just going to ride this wagon down the hill. To this day, I can't figure out what we were going to do because you go right into a busy street. I don't know what we were thinking. But we went up the hill with this wagon. And we got to the top of the hill, and we then began to think, you know, kids don't think ahead. And we're thinking, what are we going to do with the wagon? Somebody's going to steal it. So we found this field where we could hide the wagon. We could still see the school up on top of the hill because Omaha, in our part of Omaha, was very hilly. We'd go up one hill, come down the next, and we're coming up the next. And there in a field, we started hiding the wagon. Well, then our minds began to start thinking, hey, somebody may still steal this thing. And nobody's going to miss us at school. So this field was high with weeds, and so we just kind of crouched down around the wagon and waited for all our classmates to go to school. And we heard the bell ring off into the distance. We stood up and looked around. Nobody was there. And we pulled the wagon and started heading back home, but figured, well, the babysitter is there. This is not going to be good. So we just thought, well, let's just go off into the woods. And there were some woods right there. And there we just played and had a good time. And I specifically remember what I was doing. I was trying to find ladybugs. And I was putting all these ladybugs in the wagon. I probably had 100 to 200 ladybugs in that wagon, but the problem was they kept flying out and crawling out. So I kept trying. I don't know why I remember that, but I remember that. And we got to thinking, hey, kids are going to be dismissed from school for lunch. I mean, we were there for a couple hours. And so when we started seeing the kids off in the distance coming home, we began to go behind trees and watch them walk by, kind of having fun. And that's when I saw my sister, Judy, my oldest sister, walking by crying. We're like, what's she crying for? And then we saw my brother Delmer walking by. He said, hey, Delmer. He goes, what are you guys doing? And he came up to us. He said, you guys are in big trouble. The principal has been notified. Nobody can find you. You better get home. Well, all of a sudden, the realization began to hit. We were stupid. And so we pulled the wagon back home, got home. Judy was there. And instead of being glad to see us, she started chewing us out like older sisters do. And she said, you wait until Mom and Dad get back. What we didn't know is that Dad was coming home that evening. We knew we were guilty. And we are anticipating judgment. And rightfully so. I have never been spanked as hard. In fact, it's one of those things I can't remember today. I think my mind blanked out. I'll never forget that I got a spanking because it was such a severe spanking. The judgment came. You know, people know they're guilty. And when you know you're guilty, you know the judgment is coming. Look again at verse 17. God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world. The world as a whole. Here's the compassionate love of God. You see, when a sheep willfully strays, it expects punishment, but the good shepherd comes seeking to save that which was lost and returns rejoicing. When we were found, there was rejoicing. But there was also judgment. And when we were found, there was rejoicing, but we still die. The compassionate love of God is demonstrated in giving, verse 16, in sending, the first part of verse 17. Thirdly, in saving, the last part of verse 17, first part of verse 18. Look at the last part of verse 17. But that the world through him might be saved, he that believeth on him is not condemned. Verse 18 makes it clear that the world in verse 17 refers to its inhabitants, not this globe. The third time in four verses the word believeth is used. What must the sinner do? Believe. Is not condemned is the same as saying that he is pardoned, justified, cleared of all guilt. This is justification by faith. This is justification by believing. Jesus does not judge the believer because he who accepts the salvation he brings is no longer a subject of judgment. And it speaks of the present. Notice it says, he that believeth on him, verse 18, is not condemned. Not shall not, is not. The moment the sinner believes, his sin is removed and he is counted righteous. But it also does include the future. The believer will not be subjected to an investigation, judged. Why? Because you have believed into him. He will appear before the tribunal We will appear before the tribunal. Indeed, according to Romans chapter 14 and verse 10 and 2 Corinthians 5, 10, but to be recognized as saved and to receive his place, our place in the kingdom. Not to be judged for our sin because that has been judged. Oh, the compassionate love of God that he would do that for us. That's why Paul says in Romans 8, 1, there is therefore now no condemnation to them which are in Christ Jesus. Imagine the lost sheep being found. Putting its complete dependence upon the shepherd is not being judged, but is being rescued. That's one of the words for saved, deliverance, rescue. We've been rescued. Okay, so we know of the love, we know of the compassionate love of God. But men tend to just, they hear that. They hear that God loves you and they just dismiss that. And you may think about the love of God and say, well, that's very nice and I appreciate that. But folks, I want you to come to the second point. And it's the second thing that is addressed here in this passage by Jesus himself. There needs to be the corresponding love of man. In other words, will your love respond to God's love? Will your love reciprocate? You see, love should always be reciprocal because we love him because he first loved us. There is a reciprocation. At least it's reciprocal among humans. That woman who loved the gold received nothing in return from the gold. You can love an inanimate object. You will get no love in return. But it's interesting that you can love a dog, and a dog will love you back. And yet God so loved the world and does not even do what a dog will do. And respond to the love of God. For love to be expressed in all its fullness, there must be mutual love, each for the other. Leon Morris says in a commentary. You see, love by its very nature must be voluntary. An automaton cannot love its maker. You can make an object with your own hands. And it intrigues me how people can do that. Like Ed, he can make something. And you go, wow, that is so cool. And I love what he did. But as much as you try, you can't get that thing to love you back. If you are really to love God, you must be able to choose of your own free will to love God in response to God's love for you. Since man is free to love God, he is also free to not love God. So whether or not you choose to love God is demonstrated by three things that we see in these verses. Number one, dependence. Look at the last part of verse 18. But he that believeth not is condemned already, because he hath not believed in the name of the only begotten Son of God. You see, whether or not you really love God is demonstrated by your choice of dependence. He that believeth not is condemned already. Nicodemus, the man to whom Jesus is speaking here, would have divided mankind into the circumcised and the uncircumcised, Jew and Gentile, keeper of the law, breaker of the law. Today, we would divide people by race, by political party, by wealth. But Jesus divides the world into believer, unbeliever. So you may ask, how could there possibly be condemnation if God so loved the world? Because of man's response to God's love. Instead of accepting that love, resulting in his salvation, he ignores and sometimes he even hates it, resulting in his judgment. And when you read that phrase, he that believeth not is condemned already, literally means this: he that believeth not has already been judged. In other words, the unbeliever has pronounced judgment upon himself. You may go to the Louvre in Paris, France, see the Mona Lisa, and say, that's rubbish. Well, that's not telling us anything about that work of art. That's telling us something about you. And he who depreciates the Lord Jesus Christ has passed judgment, not on Jesus Christ, but upon himself. Tells us more about you. Imagine a lost sheep running away from its shepherd, wanting to remain independent. That sheep has already judged himself or itself. And what is that judgment? Well, that brings us to the next verse. Whether or not you love God is demonstrated not only by your choice of dependence, but by darkness. You have chosen darkness, verse 19. And this is the condemnation, that light has come into the world and men loved darkness rather than light because their deeds were evil. Man has no excuse for not believing in Jesus Christ. A man sits in a dark room. The bright light comes in and he tries to go into the corner, into the dark closet. You see, he saw the light and he hated the light because he didn't like what the light did. What does light do? The light makes him and his deeds visible. So man is really like a cockroach. Moving away from the light, running from the light. We don't know that much about cockroaches here in Colorado. But down south, they're everywhere. Big. And really hard to kill. I remember the guys on first floor of Graves Dormitory kept a tally on their door about how many cockroaches they killed in the room. I am not kidding. I remember it was mid-semester. It was almost like notches in somebody's gun. They had already killed 100 cockroaches in their room by mid-semester. There were so many cockroaches sometimes that I remember going to breakfast one morning, sitting across from a guy, and we were talking about cockroaches, and no kidding, he had this sweater on because it was cold outside, and all of a sudden I saw some antennas coming up out of his sweater, and I'm looking at him, I'm just smiling. And this cockroach pops up and starts looking around. I said, man, there's a cockroach in your sweater. And he freaked out. And that cockroach jumped out and ran. They were everywhere, but they hate the light. You walk into a room, you turn a light on, that's when you see the scurrying take place. Cockroach, that's man. Because it exposes him. It shows him to be what he really is. And it's no accident that cockroaches don't come to the light. Because they love darkness rather than light. Some live in darkness and some love darkness. There's a big difference. Those who live in the darkness, but who are seeking light, have hope. But the lovers of darkness are lost. They have judged themselves. You see, men go to hell not because God condemned them there, but because they loved darkness rather than light. They go to hell not because there's lacking evidence for the resurrection. They loved darkness rather than light. They go to hell not because God was unloving or unwilling to save them, but because, say it with me, they love darkness rather than light. And in Jesus, and rejecting Jesus, the unbeliever judges himself. And this is what we've got to understand, and this is what is so hard to explain to an unsaved man who says, well, I don't believe God would send anybody to hell. Really, when it comes right down to it, you are sending yourself. Because he expressed his love to you, his compassionate love to you, but you have not reciprocated back to his love. And when he stands before Jesus Christ one day, at the great white throne, He will simply hear the ratification of the sentence he has already pronounced upon himself. That word rather, in verse 19, is significant. It indicates a choice has been made. A preference has been taken. You see, a man's salvation is entirely of God. His ruin, if he is lost, is entirely from himself. His blood is on his own head. The blame lies at his own door. Eternal misery is the result of his own choice. God loved him, was willing to save him, but he loved darkness rather than light. So darkness will be his everlasting portion. Cast out into outer darkness, there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Matthew 8:12. To whom the mist of darkness is reserved forever. 2 Peter 2:17. To whom is reserved the blackness of darkness forever. Jude 13. By the way, when Jesus spoke this, it was dark outside. Man's response is his own judgment. Judgment for those who do not believe is this. You know what's right because of the light, and still you insist on choosing, that is, loving darkness. So compare. God so loved the world, but men so loved darkness. No wonder there's judgment. It's unimaginable that one in darkness would love it. But most do. Why? Because their actions are evil. And when you do something you don't want somebody else to know about, you look for cover. You look for the darkness. So they love darkness for that benefit. It covers. Those who love darkness are determined to persevere in it. Now again, there are those who live in it who don't like it. Say, I'm miserable. I'm seeking. They live in it, but they don't love it. That man has hope. Again, living in darkness is different than loving darkness. For example, the nature of those who are coming out of the closet, who am I referring to? Homosexuals? The nature of those who are coming out of the closet is to flaunt and to brag about their sin. Who would have ever imagined that we would come to the day where a couple of drag queens are at the library trying to teach kids and parents are taking their kids to see it? I'll tell you why. Because they love their sin. And they brag about it and they flaunt in it. They not only live in darkness, they love it. And there's no hope for those who love it. They have already judged themselves. Such people God gives over to a reprobate mind, Romans 1:28. So whether or not the love of God is demonstrated is by your choice of who you're going to depend upon, by whether you love darkness or light, and thirdly and lastly, by your deeds. Look at verses 20 and 21. For everyone that doeth evil, doeth, there's the deeds. For everyone that doeth evil hateth the light, neither cometh to the light, lest his deeds should be reproved. But he that doeth truth cometh to the light, that his deeds may be made manifest, that they are wrought in God. So in this choice of what you do, you see the response of evildoers and the response of truth doers. Verse 20 is the response of evildoers. What do they think about the light? They abhor it. It's abhorrence. Doeth evil. For everyone that doeth evil. Now, what have you learned about the ETH at the end of a King James word? It's continuous action. Doeth evil is in the present tense. They desire to persist in their evil. And if you love darkness, what is your opinion of light? You hate it. John 7:7, this is what Jesus said, the world hateth me because I testify of it that the works thereof are evil. John 15:23-24. Again, Jesus talks about, I came, if I had not come and said what I said, men would not have had sin. But he came and exposed them. If I had not come and done the works that I did, men would not have hated me. But now because I have come and done the works that I did, they hate me. Because he exposed men for what they were. To live in the light makes you a target of hate. Are you seeing this happening today? Not only do we have a bullseye painted on us, it's an illuminated bullseye because we're in the light. Those who talk and lisp about love are the most extreme haters. They hate the light. They hate it. And they especially hate it when you say, with your vocabulary, what they are. So then they call it hate speech. Light haters won't read their Bible. Light haters will not pray. Light haters have their excuses. And those excuses multiply. Evildoers take advantage of darkness to pursue wickedness. This is not accidental. You see, Jesus coming into the world was like the sun coming up this morning. His appearance brings light to the character of mankind, and they don't like the exposure. They feel like the preacher is always preaching to them. And they don't want exposure. They do want experience, by the way, but not exposure. Why do people hate holiness? And why do people hate people who maintain standards of holiness? Because it reveals what they are. It exposes them. I think it was Dr. Bob Jones Sr. who once said, what you hate and what you love reveals what you are. Verse 20, the response of evildoers, abhorrence. Verse 21, the response of truth doers, attraction. Note that the two are contrasted, put side by side. Verse 20 contrasted with verse 21. Side by side or top and bottom. Just as darkness is associated with error, falsehood and lies, so light is associated with truth. Those who are truly seeking the truth, even if it implicates them, will come to Jesus Christ. Go to John chapter 18. John chapter 18. Verse 37, Jesus standing before Pilate. Pilate asks him, art thou a king then? Jesus answered, thou sayest that I am a king. To this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world, that I should bear witness unto the truth. Everyone that is of the truth heareth my voice. Those who are truly seeking truth, even if it implicates them, will come to Jesus Christ. Note, they don't come to church. Coming to church is not coming to Jesus Christ. Coming to a Bible study is not coming to Jesus Christ. That's not even coming to the truth. It may lead you, but those who are truly seeking the truth will come to Jesus Christ. And if one comes to the light, it is because they do not dread or give in to the truth about themselves. They desire to know, what am I in the sight of God? You see, the gospel light is a mighty magnet. And any man truly searching for truth will be attracted to Jesus Christ, the truth. Not claiming perfection. Only that his deeds have been done in the power of God. And he doesn't mind the light being turned on. Law-abiding citizens don't need to hide. It's just those guys who pull the wagon up the hill and skip school. They've got to hide. You may say, well, that guy, he's such a decent man. He's such a moral man. He could almost be saved. Then it will be known by his coming to Jesus Christ, the light. Otherwise, even he is described in verse 20 as one who does not come to the light. And even his seeming good is evil, because he may do what he does for pride, for exaltation, self-exaltation, and for applause. Instead of men loving God who loved them, men instead love that which destroys them. Sin. They love it. God's love is defined through what he did through Jesus Christ on the cross. Your love is defined by what you do in response to that light. God initiates the love. You can respond. If you love him, you will realize it's only because he first loved me. But God commendeth his love toward us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. God's love is a gift. He gave his only begotten son. Your love for the light or for the darkness is your response to that gift. If you do not have eternal life and perish in hell, it is not because God does not love you. It is because you do not believe in him. It is because you rejected his love. Because you have a love. You already have something you love. You love darkness rather than light. Would you stand together, please?